Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 571, titled Fireside Chat 2, Your Mama Works for the Mossad. We're going to plunge right in, and I'm going to download, so to speak, some of the aspects of the O.J. Simpson case that people were not aware of. Again, although there's a lot of coverage of the Arab-Israeli conflict, the fundamental history is largely unknown to people due to a combination of, this country's been dumbed down, its educational process has been gutted. The media, above all else, don't do their job for partially economic reasons. Whereas we hear a lot about the Arab-Israeli conflict, the fact of the matter is what we hear is not necessarily what's going on. And that is similar to the O.J. Simpson case. Whereas everybody was deluged with coverage of the O.J. case, there are so many facts of which they were not aware due to skewed media coverage. Again, there was a report from three deputy DAs, and generally, if you know anything about jurisprudence, deputy DAs don't help the defense in a capital murder case, that Mark Furman was all over the West L.A. PD station, Furman was boasting of having had an affair with Nicole. Also, Mark Furman was head of a white supremacist group within the LAPD called WASP, an acronym for White Anglo-Saxon Policeman, but Lance Ito would not permit that to be introduced into evidence, in part perhaps because his wife was not only the highest-ranking female member of the LAPD, but had been Furman's watch commander and had had to discipline Furman for writing KKK on the Martin Luther King holiday on the calendar on the station wall. Ito's wife claimed she had no recollection of Mark Furman. Hell, she was his watch commander. Then Mark Furman lied on the stand about where he was and what he was doing the night of the killings during the pretrial hearing, and O.J. and Nicole were getting written and telephone death threats from white supremacist groups, including white supremacist groups associated with the LAPD. The case was skewed in so many other ways as well. There was a mountain of exculpatory evidence, but the public was not told that. Indeed, there was an organized conspiracy within LAPD to falsify evidence. However, the media did not report that. And one could go on and on about the distortion of the facts in that case. Suffice it to say that when the civil case opened up and when the defense there began to reveal much of the falsified evidence, it was not reported. If one did not read the local section, not the front section, but the local section of the LAPD and most people, of the Los Angeles Times, Freudian slip, then you certainly would not know about this. But among the things that came out was the fact that, and this was during the civil case, that the crime scene photos had been cropped in order to not show some bloody male footprints going out the front gate. O.J. supposedly left out the back, and the Akita's footprints, also bloody, went out the front gate. Also, crime scene photos of the back gate taken right after the killings showed no blood on the back gate. Later, blood appeared, and it had high levels of EDTA, a preservative, which, if it were present at that level in a human being, would have killed them. But the public did not get told about this. Detective Kelly Muldorfer, an LAPD detective, testified that when she searched the car, she found no blood in it. How did the blood get there? There was a cameraman who was using a video camera to record the inside of O.J.'s residence, and the video didn't show any bloody socks initially at O.J.'s place. Well, the cameraman testified that, in fact, he saw no socks there, but the prosecution contended that the video camera was off. The timer in the video camera was off by a full 24 hours. I'll let you decide about that. The blood, by the way, was in one large glob on the one side of the sock and soaked through, which it wouldn't have done if there'd been a foot in it. The gloves, quite obviously, did not fit O.J. Simpson. They didn't come anywhere near covering his hands. And what the public, however, did not get told was that the rationale was that the blood had caused the leather to shrink so much. Well, I grew up in the Northeast, and I used to wear leather gloves and make snowballs. Let me tell you, the leather gloves do shrink slightly when they get wet, but not nearly enough so they won't fit you. The leather stretches. What people did not see was a very obvious knife cut across the back of the right-hand glove. O.J. Simpson is right-handed. Huh. How do you suppose that happened? In his book, Detective Van Adder testified in no uncertain, wrote that for a week he was driving around with blood samples of O.J. and both victims in his car. Why? This was evidence that should have been booked in. What the hell was Van Adder doing with blood of O.J. and Ron and Nicole? Well, three guesses. He was helping, in all probability, helping to plant it. Certainly there's no logical explanation for that. The entire case, basically, was fashioned out of whole cloth. There's the notion that there was a history of abuse. In fact, there was no history of abuse. There was one incident of violence between O.J. and Nicole. In their divorce proceedings, Nicole testified that the incident, which I'm going to talk about, was the only time O.J. had ever been violent with her, and there's no credible evidence that any of the other alleged incidents ever took place. That incident, by the way, was on New Year's Eve. They were both drunk. They were having a fight about sex. O.J. wanted to end the fight. He had a lock on his bedroom door, so he tried to lock himself away. Nicole unlocked the door and came in, and then O.J. put her in a headlock and wrestled her out the door. The injuries that she sustained were it was bruising around the top of the head when the hemorrhaging then went into her eye sockets and some of the hollows in her cheeks. She was not struck. O.J. testified that he did not strike her with his fist. And that was used by people as evidence that O.J. was a liar and this, that. You know, if O.J. had hit her with her his fist, she wouldn't have looked like that. Nicole was not living in fear of O.J. She had a pizza party at O.J.'s place about 3 weeks before the killing. And indeed, she testified, as I said, at her divorce hearing that that was the only time O.J. was violent with her. Now, the other alleged incidents, by the way, happened when the cops who'd been at that one incident, again, New Year's Eve, they're both drunk, they're having a fight about sex along with about 2 million other couples on any given New Year's Eve. And they said, they asked people within the station house, does anybody recall any other incidents of violence with O.J. Simpson and his wife? And who should pipe up but, surprise, surprise, Mark Furman. The same Mark Furman who conducted the illegal search of O.J.'s property, the same Mark Furman who's head of a white supremacist group within LAPD, and the same Mark Furman identified in a report from three deputy DAs as having boasted of having an affair with Nicole. And Furman chimed up and said, yeah, there were these other incidents. That's where that comes from. Among the many things people did not get told was the fact that the entire case, one of the reasons a lot of people who could have spoken up about O.J.'s innocence did not, was because the entire milieu and virtually everybody in it, including O.J. himself, had connections to organized crime. And in turn, there was a rash of murders around the case when it broke. There was an article in the Buffalo News not long after the killings that identified two Buffalo area organized crime figures named Militello and a guy named Casimir Butch Casey Shush Sharsky as having been involved with O.J. And by the way, the world of professional sports, in the NFL in particular, have very, very strong links to organized crime. I talked about that in For the Record program number 304 called Illegal Procedure. It's a good book called Interference by Dan Moldea that talks about the mob in the NFL. About a week after that article, maybe 2 weeks after that article linking O.J. with Sucharski and Militello appeared in the Buffalo News, Sucharski was found murdered in a fashion not unlike the way O.J.'s, Ron and Nicole were murdered. He was found slashed all to bits in Florida. A fellow who had worked with Ron Goldman at the Mezzaluna, a fellow waiter named Michael Nigg, was a defense witness. He was murdered 2 days before he was going to testify. The papers barely reported the killing at all, and they said there was no connection with the case. Well, in fact, he was a defense witness and was murdered 2 days before he was going to testify. In the book Killing Time by Donald Freed, there is discussion of the Mezzaluna Cafe as an alleged organized crime front. There are serious indications that both Ron and Nicole may very well have been prostitutes. Ron Goldman, according to information in Killing Time and also another book that was published in Sweden, had been involved with those kinds of activities out of the Mezzaluna. He was allegedly, according to those sources, acting in gay porno films, working as a gay prostitute. He was not interested in Nicole for sexual reasons. Part of the whole case was presumed that Ron Goldman was having an affair with Nicole and that O.J. in a jealous rage, blah, blah, blah. Well, Ron wasn't interested in women, folks, and not only that, but according to Killing Time, he was getting death threats from his pathologically jealous gay lover. One of the things that came out during the O.J. case was the fact that Nicole had been socializing with Heidi Fleiss's girls. Heidi Fleiss, you'll recall, was the Hollywood madam. People may remember the 911 call in the O.J. case. What that was all about, by the way, O.J. did not, as the media falsely reported, break down the door. But that argument was over the fact that Nicole was socializing late at night with some of the call girls from Heidi Fleiss's ring. Well, bearing in mind, first of all, that Nicole herself was having serious financial problems, who socializes late at night with groups of prostitutes? Basically, there are four categories of people. Johns, pimps, madams, and other hookers. And Nicole was not a john, she wasn't a pimp, she wasn't a madam. So was she another hooker? Anyway, that was the reason why O.J. was mad at Nicole. And that was the fight they were having. O.J. didn't like the idea of his wife, his ex-wife, bringing hookers over to the residence where their kids lived. And I can't say, frankly, as I blame him under the circumstances. O.J. himself had a lot of links to organized crime. Fred Goldman's wife, Patty, was no stranger to the world of organized crime. Her former husband, a Chicago-area narco attorney named Marvin Glass, who not only defended high-profile narcotics dealers, but who also was alleged to have laundered money for narcotics traffickers, was convicted of solicitation for murder and died of a fast-acting case of AIDS in prison. After that, his ex-wife, Patty, married Fred Goldman, so she had a lot of experience with those kinds of things. There was a book published in Sweden not too long ago, several years ago, that alleged that Fred Goldman had similar connections. I cannot confirm that, but those were the allegations in the book. Again, the entire milieu of O.J. and everybody around them intersected with organized crime. Denise, Nicole's sister, who sort of led the charge to demonize O.J., was dating a fellow named Tony Rome. He was a former, his name was, he called himself Tony the Animal and Tony Rome, but he was a former mob enforcer turned federal informant. The entire milieu, again, is just rife with organized crime and organized vice, and yet the public wasn't told this. One of the most interesting cases, one of the most interesting things about the O.J. case concerned a Bay Area talk show host named Dwayne Garrett, who had a program on KGO, the major AM talk station here. Dwayne Garrett, shortly after the killings, announced that O.J., Dwayne Garrett was deeply involved not only with Democratic politics, but also with sports memorabilia. Dwayne Garrett announced that O.J. was going to get millions of dollars from Edward J. DeBartolo Jr., the then owner of the San Francisco 49ers, to become the first black NFL franchise owner, but that O.J. turned it down because of the DeBartolo family's apparent organized crime connections. By the way, the book Interference by Dan Moldea goes into those at considerable length. Shortly after that, Dwayne Garrett began receiving death threats, and about a year after that, he went off the Golden Gate Bridge, an alleged suicide. I would note in that regard that the DeBartolo's primary place of business is the state of Ohio. The next new NFL franchise was in Cleveland, in Ohio. And interestingly enough, both O.J. and Al Cowlings himself, with many organized crime connections, he was a driver for Joey Ippolito, who was one of the heirs to the Lansky Syndicate in L.A. Both Al Cowlings and Robert Kardashian, O.J.'s friend and attorney, were being investigated in connection with the largest sports betting ring in California. They're being investigated by a grand jury. Interestingly enough, both O.J. and Al Cowlings finished their careers with the San Francisco 49ers, and the new NFL franchise that, according to Dwayne Garrett, Eddie DeBartolo was going to have O.J. front for, hired Carmen Policy, the former general manager of the 49ers, to be their general manager, and Dwight Clark, the former director of football operations for the 49ers, then was promptly hired to fill in a similar situation in for the new Cleveland Browns, which proves nothing but certainly suggests that Dwayne Garrett may very well have been onto something. One could go on and on about that, but the point that I'm making here is that the public was not told this, and I'm just scratching the surface here. The public was not told this because the media didn't do their job. They functioned like a matrix. Some of the most disturbing things about the O.J. case concern the profound distortions of criminal law and jurisprudence. During the civil case, for example, in the run-up to the civil case, the California state legislature passed a law that received almost no coverage, permitting Nicole's, quote, diary, unquote, to be entered into evidence in the civil case. Well, that not only violated the prescriptions, the prohibitions against most types of hearsay evidence in a capital murder case. There are some circumstances under which hearsay evidence can be admitted, but it's rare. The fact of the matter is that that diary was not a diary as such. It was a thought journal, basically, that Nicole was maintaining for her therapist, and it included her dreams and fantasies. So now there is legal precedent for having dreams and fantasies introduced as evidence in a criminal trial. With that law passed virtually in secret by the California state legislature, American jurisprudence went back to the Salem witch trials. And during the civil case, one of the ways in which the prosecution was able to obtain a judgment on their favor, in their favor against O.J., is because there were a number of obviously falsified pictures of O.J. Simpson wearing what purported to be Bruno Mali shoes. Well, among the pictures that were produced were O.J. allegedly, these were computerized falsifications, O.J. wearing what purported to be gray Bruno Mali shoes. Well, Bruno Mali had never made a gray shoe. And the reason why that washed was because the judge barred O.J.'s counsel from examining the evidence against his client. People may notice I haven't done a lot of discussion of the Patriot Act and the Guantanamo situation. The fact of the matter is that American jurisprudence was gone with the O.J. case. Now, dreams and fantasies can be used as evidence in court against you, and your defense attorney can be barred as a matter of legal procedure from examining the evidence against you, against his client or her client. Well, basically, the rupturing of Anglo-Saxon legal procedure that has received a lot of attention in the wake of September 11th had actually taken place long before that. Anglo-Saxon jurisprudence was dead with the O.J. case, but people weren't told. Similar situation obtains vis-a-vis the Arab-Israeli conflict. The history of it is something that one can read about, but there are many aspects of that history that have not been told. First of all, the Palestinian national cause is at all times, and everybody connected with it for all intents and purposes, is at all times identified not only with fascism but with genocide. The first leader of the Palestinian National Movement was a guy named Haj Amin al-Husseini of the very powerful Husseini clan in that part of the world. We should note that the area that is now Israel and the occupied territories was part of the Ottoman Empire for hundreds of years. And in that part of their empire, the Turks maintained sort of a tripartite realpolitik dynamic. There were three basic clans that they manipulated. There were the Husseini clan, of which Haj Amin al-Husseini was a member, the Nashashibi clan, and the Hashemites. The Husseinis and the Nashashibis were rivals for control of Jerusalem, and the Hashemites and the Husseinis were rivals for control of Mecca and Medina, the holiest places in Islam. Because the Husseinis had a line into Jerusalem and into Mecca and Medina, they were favored by the Ottoman Turks because basically playing ball with the Husseinis gave them a line into the control or political control over the three holiest places in Islam, and that was deemed essential for sustaining the caliphate. Haj Amin al-Husseini began his career as an officer in the Turkish army in World War I. That was the Turkish army that was committing genocide against the Christian Armenians. I recently heard a broadcast in which one of the guiding lights on the Pacifica Network, who shall remain anonymous under the circumstances, was defending Haj Amin al-Husseini as a, quote, Arab nationalist, unquote. Well, he was not only an SS officer, more about that in a minute. But this, quote, Arab nationalist, unquote, began his professional life as an officer in the Turkish army in World War I. That's the same Turkish army that was committing genocidal, not genocidal, but brutal counterinsurgency campaigns against the Arab Legion, headed up by Captain T.E. Lawrence. There's a good portrayal of that in the movie Lawrence of Arabia. He weren't no Arab nationalist. When the British took over that part of the old Ottoman Empire, they put the same imperial dynamic into place. They began favoring the Husseinis because, again, because the Husseinis had a line in Jerusalem, Mecca, and Medina, their siding with them was viewed as a good vehicle for control. the conflict between the Arabs and the people we now call the Palestinians began at that point, long before there was a Jewish state. In fact, Haji Amin al-Husseini was organizing pogroms against Jews who had moved to that part of what had been the Ottoman Empire between the world wars, and doing so basically with the connivance of the British. The League of Nations in the early 1920s drew up what they called the 7723 solution, basically acknowledging that the Balfour Declaration, this was a statement, and frankly a rather cynical one by the British Empire, that they would cede that portion of the old Ottoman Empire to the Jews as a basically as a quid pro quo for Jewish support in World War I. Well, in recognition of the Balfour Declaration, the League of Nations basically formally ruled that Britain, which was the protector of that portion of the territory, would ultimately partition the land into 77% for the Arabs and 23% for the Jews, later the Israelis. However, the British ultimately went back on that during the Peel Commission of the late 30s. They went back on their promise of the Balfour Declaration and began making similar promises to the Arabs. We should note that Haji Amin al-Husseini not only continued to launch pogroms against the Jews between the world wars, but ultimately he sided with the Nazis, became a major in the SS, recruited numerous Muslim fighting formations for the Axis, including three Balkan Muslim Waffen-SS divisions, and then after World War II, with the European Jewish population having been largely exterminated, and with the rest of them basically having had their possessions confiscated, by the way, in many cases, quote, Aryanized, unquote, by powerful German corporations, which were part of the international cartels with which American transnational corporations and people like the Bush family and the Rockefeller family and others, the Harrimans and others of the robber barons were closely associated. Israel was set up as a repository for the displaced Jewish population of Europe. The Zionist movement had existed for a long time, but it really... The formation of the State of Israel is inextricably linked with the Holocaust. Had there been no Holocaust, it is highly unlikely there would be no Israel. And one should understand that. And one should also understand that Haji Amin al-Husseini went from being a major in the SS and a key Axis collaborator to being the first head of the Palestinian National Movement. Originally, Israel was set up. It was going to be a tiny little country, and either Arabs living in that part of what became known as Palestine had the option of either living in peace inside of the Jewish state, which some of them chose to do, by the way. That's why there are 1.4 million Arab Israelis today. Or they could set up their own territory, which they never made any significant attempt at doing. Then, basically, when Israel came into existence, there was a war of extermination in which those Arabs who later became known as Palestinians allied with the existing Arab nations to fight a war of extermination, but they lost. The Israel that came out of the War of Independence in 1948 was actually territorially larger than what it was supposed to be. And that, basically, is where things stand. One never hears, however, well, seldom hears, about the 1.4 million Israeli Arabs. And there are a lot of aspects of the history we simply don't hear about. Many of the Arabs who left their homes in the run-up to the 48 war did so at the behest of their leaders. This is not to say that it was necessarily voluntary, because remember that the Palestinian National Movement has not only a fascist history, but a history allied with the SS and Nazis, and when you're dealing with people of that ilk, you basically do as you're told or you face retribution. But one never hears about the fact that a large percentage of the Arabs who left their homes in what is today Israel did so voluntarily. One never hears about the fact that a large number of Arabs did, relatively large number, did actually stay there and lived in peace, albeit somewhat uneasy, with the Jews. Again, Israel's population is about 6+ million. About 1.4, maybe 1.2 million of those are Arab Israelis. There are a lot of things one never hears about the Arab-Israeli conflict. It would be impossible to sum them all up. Oh, by the way, a couple of corrections. One of the things that you never hear about are the Mizrahi. After the 48 War of Independence, the Arab nations then conducted over a period of decades ethnic cleansing of their own Jewish population. and roughly 900,000 Jews from the Arab countries were expelled and their property was confiscated. Most of them settled in Israel, and they are known in Israel as the Mizrahi, M-I-Z-R-A-H-I is the usual transliteration. They are the electoral power base of the Israeli right. Correction, though, they do not necessarily constitute the majority of the settlers in the occupied territories, but they're a nice chunk of them. They are the electoral foundation for the Israeli right wing, and they are Jews who were ethnically cleansed from the Arab countries and their property was confiscated. Their attitude is F the Arabs in general and the Palestinians in particular. It's our turn now. But one does not hear about that. By the same token, one does not hear about the fact that the Camp David Accord that was rejected by Yasser Arafat in 2000. By the way, I talk about what I call the July surprise, what I consider to be the subversion of that by American, Saudi, and some right-wing Israeli elements, as well as good old Yasser Arafat. That's in For the Record program number 449. But one of the provisions of that peace agreement was to be a common market between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Were going to have a common market, but you never hear about that. Another correction, by the way, in the ceding of the Gaza Strip back to the Palestinians, by the way, they then used it to bombard Israel. One of the things that took place there is a kibbutz that had some very high-quality hydroponic vegetable growing facilities, which they exported to Europe. That was not 10 to 20% of Israel's hard foreign currency earnings per year, but they constituted about 10 to 20% of Israeli agricultural exports. A group of American Jews bought those, basically, those hydroponic growing facilities and the storage warehouses, because it would have provided some 24,000 high-paying jobs to the Palestinians. Yet the Palestinians trashed them, thereby destroying 24,000 good jobs, which, like the common market that they rejected, or at least Arafat rejected, would have been the best thing that the Palestinians could possibly have had. There are other aspects of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that we could go into, but we haven't got time. The occupation of the territories there is not technically illegal. It has been decried by the Security Council of the United Nations, but that would only be illegal if a sovereign nation claimed that territory. The Palestinians have never been a sovereign nation, and Jordan does not claim the West Bank, and Egypt doesn't claim the Gaza Strip. It should be noted that the UN resolutions, which have called for the Israeli abandonment of those territories, are under Article 6. But, well, we really haven't got time here in this broadcast to go into the United Nations vis-a-vis the Israeli conflict. That is quite complex, because the and again, very different from what people have been told. The UN Security Council resolutions have recommendation and enforcement provisions, one under Article or Chapter 6, the other under Article or Chapter 7. They're quite a bit different. Plus, the foundation of the United Nations is the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It's a great document, originally conceived in large measure by Eleanor Roosevelt, but the Saudis, who financed the Palestinians, have rejected that. In fact, although a charter member of the UN, they issued the competing Universal Declaration of Muslim Rights, thereby indicating that only Muslims had rights. There are many other aspects of the Israeli-Palestinian question I could go into, the point being that the public hasn't been told. And it reminds me of the O.J. Simpson case. So when examining the Middle East and when examining, you know, it was the Jews, yeah? Remember that the media are not telling the truth. Oh, before I sign off here, again, I could go on at much greater length here, but time marches on. At the beginning of the program, I mentioned the Chinese Intelligence Service. How many of you can name the Chinese Intelligence Service? Well, this is a trick question. China has 135 different intelligence services. They have trouble keeping their own intelligence services straight. That concludes For the Record program number 571, Fireside Chat 2. Your mama works for the Mossad. This has been recorded on October 1st of 2001. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.